I'm Julie Bullitt. I've been a family therapist for over 30 years.
I'm David Bullitt. I've been a divorce and family lawyer for more than 35 years.
Together, we have been married for more than 37 years.
In our professional practices, the two of us have been witnesses to individuals and families struggling with life's most difficult challenges. In this podcast, we will talk about the conversations we have had,
the conversations we should have had,
and those that every relationship needs to have in order to find success, happiness, and fulfillment.
This is Conversations for Couples,
the podcast. So all the way from Southern California today, we have artist and author, blogger and speaker Tracy Yocas. Tracy is the author of Bloodlines, a memoir of harm and healing. And this book, which I read portions of, tells a story about her family's journey with mental illness and healing. And it leans on her background in education. She has a master's in counseling psychology. Yet with all of that, when you ask Tracy what she does, she says she creates stuff. So Tracy, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be here.
So let's sort of start at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about, you know, your family and how that led to writing the book. And I want to talk about the art and other things too, but let's start there.
Absolutely. Thank you. Well, our life was normal. My husband, my daughter, myself, things were going along, you know, whatever normal means. I'm not even sure I could quantify that if I wanted to, but things were just going along. And then the summer before my daughter's eighth grade year of school, this is going back to 2012, my mother unexpectedly passed away. And she and my daughter had been very close. And it was, you know, as it always is for everyone, it was a difficult time. But a couple weeks after my mother's death, my daughter woke up one day and she just wasn't very hungry. And then in a very short period of time, she was basically eating nothing at all. And we got very concerned. And that launched us onto trips to the pediatrician, of course, and then being told we really needed to get some professional help. So that was the beginning of what became a very lengthy journey and became much, much worse. Her symptoms got worse, and she was also diagnosed with severe depression and anxiety, self-harm, and just all of that before things then began to improve a couple of years later.
Yeah. Wow. So eating disorders are so tricky and complicated. And I always tell people, you know, with alcohol and drugs, you can cut them out completely, but food is, you know, you can't just say like, we're not doing food anymore. So it becomes, you know, more challenging. Can you tell us a little bit more about the complexities of eating disorders and how, as a mom and your husband as a father, supported your daughter?
You know, it's such a complicated issue, and I wish I had simple answers for people, because you're exactly right. I mean, we can stop doing lots of things, but we can't stop eating. So what we really had to learn, and I had already, by that point, my master's degree, I got it when my daughter was young, and even having that education, it's still so hard. We just really had to understand that it wasn't about how she looked. It was a self-esteem issue with some control components. And even when you understand that, or are working to understand it, when you're sitting day after day after day with your child refusing to eat food, and of course, your brain needs a lot of calories to function properly. So you're watching your child not eat and emotionally deteriorate at the same time. It's just extremely terrifying. And to be told, of course, it makes complete sense. Don't have power struggles with your child over food. Like, okay, you know, that makes complete sense on the surface. But again, when you're sitting in your home and your kid isn't eating and they're 13 and they're supposed to be going through puberty and then, you know, not getting their period anymore and all the things that go along with that, it's very, very difficult. So I would say, over time, it took me a long time to understand this. And frankly, I think it took my husband even longer to understand. We had to learn how, because neither one of us had good tools for this, to deal with our own emotional upheaval in order to be able to support her better. And that took a very long time.
Tell me a little bit about, you know, how the two of you managed together once she started exhibiting these symptoms and as you said, sort of going downhill for a period of time. How did the two of you handle it together? How'd you communicate? Were there problems? And if so, how'd you solve them?
Yeah, the short answer is poorly. I mean, I will just be honest. It was terrible. I mean, I think we didn't realize until after, I guess you just take things for granted. So, you know, because things had been going along again, quote unquote, normally for so long, it's like, oh, we're fine. We communicate, we this, we that. And it wasn't until suddenly there was this major disruption and we were both coming at it from different angles. I think there's gender issues there too. And he's older than I am. So there was a lot on the, you know, kind of the male side of like, just, she needs to get over this shit, you know, whatever. And of course I'm like, oh yeah, I'm going to nurture my baby. You know, I mean, I guess both of those things are important, but we didn't communicate with each other well, and we were stuck in our own mindset. He wanted what I wanted. I wanted what, you know, what I want. He wanted what he wanted. I wanted what I wanted. And we weren't finding some middle ground there. And so then being, again, told by professionals, like, you guys really need to get on the same page. Well, again, that's great conceptually. But when you're in your home and you're living this crisis every day and things are getting more and more and more out of control, and all of us are reacting to everything that's happening, it's very, very, very difficult. So we did spend not long after the process get rolling, when we realized that individual therapy wasn't going to be enough, which only took a couple months. And my daughter's therapist was like, this isn't working. You need to, you know, look for an eating disorder clinic near the house, get her in there every day. So we did. A large part of the work we were doing in couples therapy, because that was a requirement, was this idea of how can we communicate with one another better? How can we communicate with our daughter better? How can we not let our own emotions get in the way? And I will tell you, I didn't realize, and through my own therapy, I've been in a lot of therapy. I got in therapy the first time when I was 30. It wasn't until literally now, I'm 56, 2 years ago, that I received my diagnosis of chronic PTSD, which made everything make so much more sense. But what I try to show in the book is our history impacts our present. And so playing out also were the patterns that my husband and I had learned as children, how we communicated, we learned as children, how we couldn't communicate with one another. These patterns are very hard to break. So learning new skills and learning how to manage our own emotional upheaval was took a long time, but was part of that process.
Now, you have any other children?
My husband has two children from his first marriage, but they're much older and they were out of the house. And so there's really no involvement there.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. And as you were talking, I'm sort of, you know, thinking about David and I's, you know, history together. We've been married almost 39 years. And we talk openly about the fact that dealing with one of our four daughters who had has still a lot of mental health, behavioral issues. That was a really difficult time for us. There was times where, again, I'm a therapist, so I saw behaviors as, you know, symptoms of something else. And David sort of thought she was just being a jerk. And so as you were talking about the differences, that was sort of coming up for me.
Yeah, I mean, and it's true. And I don't know whose feelings were whose during your circumstance, but certainly with us, I was more on the side of, you know, everything doesn't necessarily require a pill or require a certain therapy. And Julie was completely on the other side of the spectrum. Now, ultimately, you know, we were able to sort of work together. It took it but there was a lot of bumps like you're talking about. A lot of, and even today, if you asked us to sit down and say, okay, who is right? Right. Or who, you know, we still would disagree about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I wanted to dive into, because I think you and I had talked about this, and I know this is a part of the book, is which is your history, you know, before you genetically, what happened before you even, you know, while you were being made, so to speak, your genes, all those kinds of things, how that affects you today. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because I'm fascinated by that.
Yeah, I mean, I can only to my capacity as a, you know, non-scientist. But what I had to learn along the line was all of that, whatever happened, and I didn't get to know any of my grandparents. So I was operating from a deficit there because I don't know their history. I think mm-hmm. maybe that's true for a lot of people, but I didn't know what was coming in. I knew my dad had survived a world war. He was mm-hmm. older than my mom, so he was a World War II veteran. My mom had survived a series of significant losses in her childhood. Her father, her stepfather passed away. A third stepfather like disappeared. And so there mm-hmm. was just a lot of trauma. But I didn't know any of this when I was a kid. So mm-hmm. I was just born into this family. And again, it didn't become clear until much later that I was also dealing with these patterns of sort of a narcissistic abuse on one side and codependency on the other. Add into that the mix that I was supposed to have a baby sister. So when I was two, my mom was full term pregnant and then delivered the baby stillborn. Mm. This was never, ever discussed. Mm-hmm. So I know that's how it was back then. I guess it was just that, like, if you don't talk about it, it didn't happen, or you'll just get over it or whatever. But of course, that's not how it actually works.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of trauma all mm-hmm. around, a lot of grief, a lot of mm-hmm. mourning that wasn't being dealt with. Nothing was being talked about. And from a very early age, like a very unhealthy relationship with food developed, not only mm-hmm. about the differences in how my parents handled it with me, but mm-hmm. again, not really talking about it. And, you know, pediatrician putting me on my first diet when I was like 11 and just this unhealthy focus on what we look like as the only measure of our health. Mm-hmm. And growing up with this, you just know what you know and you don't know what you don't know. And it mm-hmm. wasn't until my daughter became sick, it wasn't even during my education for my master's, that I could understand and see these patterns really playing out for myself mm-hmm. and the ways I had repeated them. And I think oftentimes what can also happen is we grow up and we know things didn't feel good. So I knew that the way my parents handled food with me didn't feel mm-hmm. good, but I didn't know what to do about it. So I kind of mm-hmm. just did the opposite. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to talk about it all the time. I'm not going to make it a big deal. I'm mm-hmm. not going to, you know, whatever. But of course, energetically, that is not really any more of a conscious choice. It's still a reaction. So I'm not mm-hmm. sure that that ended up being, I think that's one step forward, but it's mm-hmm. not fully to the other side of like, yes, now I'm making conscious choices. I understand where all these things, you know, how all of these patterns are playing out. Yeah. So there was just so much I didn't know until.
Yeah.
You know, the suffering began.
So now let me fast forward back to where we were. So your daughter is dealing with what she's dealing with in terms of the eating disorder. You've got the depression, and you said it was about a 3-year journey till she sort of pulled through a lot of it. I think that's what I understood. And if not, you can correct me. So tell me a little bit about, again, and you mentioned also that your husband butted heads a little bit. So tell me how you were able to, and I assume at some point you were able to start feeling at least to some degree that you were rowing in the same direction. And how did that come about? And how did it, if at all, did it change, you know, the path of your daughter's treatment and health?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I mean, honestly, we were always rowing in the same direction in terms of doing everything we could to help our daughter. That was always true. Again, what we thought that help should look like, you know, what we thought we were supposed to do, that differed. So we were always on the same page in that regard. I would say it wasn't until, I mean, we did individual treatment. We did eating disorder clinic every day after school, which became, we had to pull her out of school every day. She was there all day, which transitioned into still getting worse, residential treatment. Mm-hmm. The first place kicked her out, hospitalization, more mm-hmm. residential treatment before she was able to come home and stay home, which happened, you know, sort of quickly so that by freshman year, we had an IEP in place and she was mm-hmm. actually able to stay home. But, you know, for a long time, I really had to say to him, you need to leave. You need to leave the house. And mm-hmm. he wouldn't get in the car and drive away, but he would go outside. He would go mm-hmm. to the garage. He would whatever. That was our intermediary step because he mm-hmm. simply could not, whatever was going on inside of him, he could not handle it when she was upset. And mm-hmm. so he would raise the bar and mm-hmm. she would raise the bar more and he would raise the bar again. And then everything was out of control. So the stopgap in the short term was basically me saying, you have to listen to me. We talked about it in therapy a lot. You need to go outside and you need to let me be here. I needed to be able to be present with her and not try and do anything. I mean, for the, that was what was so hard. Another thing that was hard to understand was really the way to be helpful was to stop trying to be helpful. Because yes. trying to fix things actually isn't, as any therapist, you know, knows. Like, we think we're being helpful. You just need to calm down. You're going to be like, that does not help. No,
nobody has ever calmed down in the history of telling somebody to calm down.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. So, like, I finally figured out I need to stop doing that. Like, I just need to sit here. And, like, if she lets me, you know, she's having a meltdown or whatever, mm-hmm. eventually she would let me, like, just put my hand on her leg and like to help co-regulate. But I didn't even know what that meant, you know, at first. And nobody had ever done that for me in my childhood. That's why I had no frame of reference for that as a thing to even do, let alone that that would be helpful. So that was the beginning point really for us, was him just accepting. He doesn't know what to do. So he needed to go outside. He needed to take that energy away, go deal with himself. And then eventually over time, and especially when she came back from treatment and then school got started, and then, you know, they found their own kind of common ground. For example, she got involved in athletics, and my husband is an athlete. And so they had that, that they could find common ground on and find ways to start communicating again, that he was very helpful for her because she wasn't well. Yet, you know, she was still struggling a lot. And so that played out in a lot of different ways. And he was really able to come in there and support her, like relative to water polo and swimming and, and being an athlete himself and helping, you know, support her through that. So they kind of had to find their own common ground. And that allowed us as a couple to have more dialogue and see each other's strengths, which were not the same. And I think that's the whole point. You know, we have different strengths. All couples do. But for a long time, we weren't willing to even see that with each other because we were so lost in our own fear and terror and everything that was happening, the walking on eggshells, all of that.
So I read about you. I looked at your website. And I saw that one of the reasons, one of the big reasons that you wrote your book was to make sure that other people out there knew that they weren't alone. And there's going to be a lot of those people that are listening into this today. So if you could give them a soundbite advice, what would you tell those parents who are trying to work together to manage a mental health issue within their family?
Honestly, I would say this is really hard to hear, but you need to rip your focus. You still have to help your child, but you must rip your focus off of a hyperfixation on the child. And look, turn it inward and look at yourself and identify the own patterns that you're displaying that are unhelpful and get some professional help for yourself to be able to understand how that's negatively playing out in the entire environment. Because I look at a family like a system. And so when one part of that system changes, the whole has no choice but to change a little bit. And taking that hyper focus, it's kind of also hypocritical because none of us is a perfect person. We're all just human beings. So we as parents have to have things that just aren't, you know, perfect because we're people. So when we can, that just allows our child to have some space to breathe and to not feel like they're being told every minute of the day that they're an F up. And like, they already know they're struggling. They don't need us to like highlight every negative thing. They get it. Yeah. So when we start working on ourselves and developing some tools of our own, some things that work for us, improving our communication skills, taking responsibility for ourselves, that just also shows our child that we're willing to be in this with them. And we're willing to look at ourselves and figure out what we need to do to make the situation better.
I love that. I love that as a, you know, I've been doing family therapy for years and that's just like, that's it right there. And lots of parents are sort of unwilling to kind of own their piece. They'll bring, you know, they'll bring their kids in and say, this is, you know, Benji's problem or Susie's problem, but they're not willing to kind of see how they're, you know, playing into it and how they're interacting. So I love that. That's a great plug for family therapy.
And I'm interested in where Benji popped in from, but that's the name that you came with.
Benji, I don't know.
Tell us a little, before we go, why don't you tell me a little bit about this mixed media, the art classes that you do, the purpose of those, and what are they designed to do for folks?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. For about a year and a half, because I also got into my own therapy when my daughter got into her therapy, for about a year and a half, my therapist was asking me what I could do to take care of myself. Mm-hmm. And for a year and a half, I was so enraged by this question because I was like, what right do I have to take care of myself? My child's struggling. I just had a completely skewed view of what self-care actually is and what it is actually for. I think most of us have major misunderstandings about that. So when I finally was getting the message after all this time that I couldn't control my daughter, I couldn't control the trajectory of her illness. The only thing I could control was myself. And that maybe she had a point that I hadn't been taking very good care of myself for like for forever and put myself on my own to-do list. I felt a call to return to creativity. And it took a while, but out of coming back to that creative, we are all inherently creative as human beings. And many of us have that part of ourselves shut down if we've been told we're not, you know, talented at it to make a living. Like if you can't make money at something, it's not worth doing. So coming back to creativity, there are so many things about creativity that are liberating and freeing. Most of all, it's fun. So if for no other reason than that, it was awesome. But it helped me identify and really work on my inner critic. Because when we create things, I tell my students this all the time. I love my students so much. They help me and I help them. And it's such a symbiotic relationship. But I tell them all the time, if you call something you made ugly, you might as well look in the mirror and say the same thing to your face. So what plays out between our creative process in our journal plays out in other aspects of our life. So if we want a healthier relationship with other people, we can start that actually by a return to creativity because we can heal our relationship with ourselves using creativity. And that takes it out into our relationships with our family, other people we love, our friends, our community.
That's really very cool. Tracy, if folks want to learn more about you, get a hold of your book or find out more about your classes or anything else, what is the best way for them to reach you?
Thank you. It's my website, www.tracyyokascreates.com. There's links there for everything. There's a whole page for what I call my toolkit, which talks about other things besides creativity for health and wellness and Bloodlines, a memoir of harm and healing is available everywhere books are sold.
Awesome. And folks, we'll include all of that in the show notes. Tracy, it's been great having you. As always, folks, this is Conversations for Couples,
the podcast.
And we are The Bullitts, TheBullitts, found on all your social media platforms, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, YouTube. I think I covered all of them.
Yeah, pretty good.
Again, Tracy, thanks for coming to us from California. And we look forward to following you and seeing how the rest of your journey plays out. Have a great day.
You too. Yeah. Thanks.
Julie Bullitt is a professionally licensed clinical social worker and family therapist. David Bullitt is a divorce and family lawyer. Julie is not your therapist and David is not your lawyer. This podcast is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only.